welcome to this basic strategic dialogue breakfast, part of Peter Hussey's congressional breakfast meetings. I'm Dr. Trevor McCriskin. I'm the chair of BASIC. My day job is an associate professor at the University of Warwick in the Department of Politics and International Studies. Feel very pleased to be here today. Thank you for coming this morning. For an academic, this is extremely early in the morning, but I'll hopefully stay awake throughout what will be, I think, a very fiery discussion this morning. We're going to be focusing on US strategic interests and the role of US strategic interests in line with the renewal of the UK Trident system. That'll be the focus of this morning. Peter Hussey, President of Geostrategic Analysis, will be speaking, but also Paul Ingram, who is my executive director of BASIC, who I think will be introducing the topic first of all. BASIC has been involved in thinking about Trident for many, many years, probably since the beginning of our organisation some 25 years ago. For the last 3 years, we've been leading a special commission on Trident, the BASIC Trident Commission, which has members of all three of the major political parties, former members of administrations and those that have worked in the area of defence, the foreign ministry, etc., in the UK, to discuss the future of Trident, whether Trident should be renewed, and our report as a result of that commission will be coming out early next year. I should also say today is a bit special. We're obviously going to be taking questions from within the room, but we're also being followed on our Twitter feed, and we're going to be having some questions coming in from Twitter as well, so a very interactive session. And so far as I understand, there's lots of people on the other side of the Atlantic who are already sending in their questions and their observations.
That's early for them. It's early for us.
So anyway, without further ado, I will introduce you Paul Ingram, Executive Director of BASIC, who's going to make the first comments. Thank you.
Can I say that I'll be speaking on behalf of BASIC rather than the BASIC Trident Commission? I have to distinguish the two. I'm not going to be giving you a tutorial on Britain's nuclear arsenal numbers and history, but I will say a little bit about that. What this meeting is about looking at this from the US strategic perspective. Because Britain operates an independent continuous at sea deterrence, having a submarine out at any one time. And this really, in the end, only makes sense, I would say, if we, the UK, are operating alone. But there's no possibility of the UK facing a dire strategic threat alone. Not now, not in 10 years' time, I would say never. The use of nuclear weapons without its allies is actually inconceivable, except in any sort of fantastic scenario. And even if that were not the case, even if the Brits could face a strategic threat alone, is it really in the US interests strategically to facilitate this? And that's the question I have today. Because in the end, I think there's only one explanation, and that is that the person who said, I think it was over this side, that there are no such things as friends, only interests, has got it wrong. And that the US strategic community is actually engaged in rather a sentimental activity with the United Kingdom. My four summary points are these. Britain needs to decide whether it has faith in the alliance or not, and configure its nuclear deterrent accordingly. We should not deal in fantasy or conjecture, but consider realistic scenarios. As long as the alliance is intact and credible, the UK will never act alone. Retention of continuous at sea deterrence is an expression of a lack of faith in the alliance. My second point is that leadership in NATO is needed. The US needs to discuss, decide, and then communicate clearly what it expects of its allies in a time of constrained resource. Allies are clearly not willing to increase their defence spending and no longer can afford to have comprehensive and redundant military and nuclear capabilities. My third point is that an effective and sustainable NATO requires genuine burden sharing that is efficient and rationally focused on the real challenges facing the alliance. The UK is an important part of that, providing critical capabilities valued by the United States, most notably intelligence and special forces. These are under threat from budget cuts. My fourth point is that NATO also needs to actively consider its contribution to the non-proliferation regime. Between its three nuclear weapon states members, there are at least seven submarines on patrol at any one time. No other state has continuous patrolling. This is both wasteful and unduly threatening, driving a fear response amongst other states. We see threat in other states quite understandably, but maybe we ought to more often look in the mirror. Now, Britain's nuclear deterrent is made up of four submarines, one of which is out on patrol at any one time. We have on those submarines between 40 and 48 nuclear warheads. We're moving down to 40. We're moving down to eight operational missile tubes in each of those submarines. We have what we describe as a minimum nuclear deterrent, and we exercise with that minimum nuclear deterrent what you might call counter-value strategy. That minimum nuclear deterrent is measured specifically by an independence criteria that Britain needs to be able to act alone to have a credible nuclear deterrent. There are four criteria used to assess UK requirements. Firstly, force invulnerability, to ensure it can function irrespective of any preemptive action. Second, minimum destructive capability, to overcome defences and cause sufficient damage so that the deterrent is effective. Third, global reach, because we're less clear who we are deterring these days and because we need to be sufficiently distant from the target for assured survival. And fourth, force independence, because, well, we don't trust the Americans to be there when it counts. The Trident system is judged at present to fulfil these criteria because of its stealthiness and mobility, its global range and missile speed, the capabilities of the re-entry vehicle to evade defences, and the severe challenges adversaries have in defending against ballistic missiles. The debate in Britain over alternative systems, platforms and delivery was largely settled this summer with the Trident Alternatives Review. Just a few lone voices, such as former Defence Secretary David Owen, continue to criticise it. He has expressed disbelief in the claim that Aldermaston would require 24 years to produce a new nuclear warhead for any new delivery system, like cruise missiles. It was a result of this core finding that meant that alternative systems were deemed impractical. Now, Aldermaston has a close working relationship with the US labs, an operating annual budget of several hundred million pounds, and has 7 decades of experience designing and maintaining nuclear weapons. 24 years. Perhaps we have less to worry about in Iran than we thought. Nevertheless, there is public scepticism of the need at all for an independent nuclear deterrent. Opinion polls divide perhaps roughly 50-50. But within the main party, three main parties, it's actually about how many Trident boats will be needed with the new order and whether they still need to be configured in a way that delivers a continuous patrol. The Conservatives remain committed to like for like and continuous sea deterrence. Their allies in government, the Liberal Democrats, to reduce patrolling and fewer replacement submarines. The Labour Party is committed to renewing a UK nuclear deterrent, but is currently reserving judgment for now, waiting on the exact details of our own Trident Commission and a more general review of their policy in advance of the next election. Beyond the Scottish referendum, which I won't discuss because it's a bit of a distraction, we have the... we have the general election in May 2015, the Strategic Defence and Security Review in late 2015, and the final main gate decision of 2016. Those are the three key points. Don't expect this to be a major hotly contested issue south of the border with Scotland on which the electorate will be basing their votes. But it could yet feature in the election campaign itself, because nuclear weapons are a symbol. We in the security world understand this very, very much, because it's a fundamental basis of deterrence. But it applies politically too. The debate in Scotland, I will skate over, but there is a strong symbolism there that the SNP, the nationalists, are picking up on. It's not necessarily that people north of the border care passionately about these things, but they are very symbolic of decisions made in London. But the Liberal Democrats are also desperately looking for issues that separate them from their allies in government when they come to contest most of their seats against Conservatives in the next election. And this is one of the few issues that does distinguish the two parties. But there is also much in common between the parties on this issue. There will always be differences of opinion around when and how far Britain can engage in steps on its own initiative and when it is more appropriate to hold back for multilateral steps. But so far, reductions in warheads and systems, readiness and posture have been quite extensive in the UK case since the Cold War and have been broadly supported by the leaderships of all three main political parties. Reductions made possible because the UK deemed those systems unnecessary to its own security and because successive governments have recognised the need to show faith in the NPT. We need also to consider the importance of alliance and international institutions in the 21st century. As we face the challenges ahead, with likely stresses around climate change, increasing demands from rising populations, less content to accept poverty and marginalisation, threat challenges arising in a number of spheres, it is no less important that we consider them as a team of states united in a common purpose, global security. The international institutions of our time, be they NATO or the UN, demand stronger signals of commitment, not less. This is widely recognised in the UK, probably a lot less controversial than it might be over here. It is also the only rational reason for Britain to retain a nuclear deterrent, because there's no significant possibility of Britain facing alone a threat that needs an operationally independent nuclear deterrent any time in the future. And retaining the capability for independent action shows a lack of faith in its core alliances. Nuclear weapons are all about signals. But are those the signals we, the Brits, want to convey? And are they being picked up here in Washington, signals of a lack of trust? And does it make sense to justify the current posture on the basis that it is operationally independent when it is so heavily dependent on the relationship with the United States to keep the deterrent afloat, or perhaps more accurately, under the sea? On the other hand, if Britain's nuclear patrolling were more coordinated within the alliance, and in particular with the US Trident system, wouldn't this demonstrate greater clarity of purpose, save money, and reassure other states of the intentions behind these systems? Because we would no longer need separate national continuous at sea deterrence postures. Today, with three independent states within NATO practicing overlapping national CASD on the basis that each is unable to cede an inch of sovereignty to the other, is hardly the best advert for appeals to other states, either to believe in extended deterrence on the one hand, or to place their faith in the NPT. After all, many of them face far greater security threats than Britain and France. US leadership is needed to empower and encourage cooperation. The inability of allies to contemplate the modernisation in their nuclear posture during the strategic concept discussions and the subsequent deterrence and defence posture review appeared to come down to a veto from the French. This weekend suggests they may have got into the habit. Now, they have their reasons, and those who would strongly criticise would do well to look at the dysfunctional divisions within political systems across the alliance. But at the same time, we cannot allow global security to be held hostage by paranoia or national pride. The future of the alliance cohesion and credibility remains at stake. We could also be driving nuclear proliferation, perhaps the biggest threat to our own national security. Now, the middle powers, including the UK, also have responsibility for effective burden sharing within the alliance and within the wider UN system. This requires appropriate investment with limited resources, one that genuinely contributes to security and stability and addresses the priority of the day. Legacy systems, more appropriate to previous threats, have no place when we are already stretched. And we have to think very carefully about indefinite investments in systems based upon mutual annihilation with countries we need to partner with. The traps we are in are co-created, and it should not be beyond our capabilities to climb out of them together. The Russians' posture and deployment of nuclear weapons, to some extent, mirror our own. It is going to take a good deal of effort to find ways of persuading them to join us in the next steps when it comes to further reductions in numbers and the careful walk away from nuclear deterrence in the long run. But this does not mean we should not try. We have a situation where in London a decision will probably be taken to fully renew the existing system, at least partly on the basis that to do otherwise would be to undermine the special relationship with the United States, something that is highly valued within London. And yet the reason for retaining a fully independent deterrent on patrol at all times is at least in part because the UK might at some stage need to launch a nuclear weapon without US support, perhaps even in the face of US opposition. Could it be in the US interest that the British align their nuclear deterrent more closely with NATO and the United States and demonstrate a clearer faith in the effectiveness of the alliance? And would the US be able to clarify its preferences to its ally? If it does not, London will likely default to the status quo, starving funds for capabilities perhaps more use to the alliance and the United States. By doing so, it could give the impression that it cannot rely upon the United States in the final analysis and undermine faith in extended deterrence elsewhere and contribute to proliferation.
I want to thank you all for being here today. I'm in an unusual position of speaking at my own seminar series. For those of you interested, we're currently transcribing our event in Kings Bay, Georgia, which was an extraordinary event where we heard from British Admiral Weberstock. And we are going to be doing a bomber triad event, hopefully in Whiteman Air Force Base. We're also looking at doing another one here in Washington, sponsored by our friends in Minot, North Dakota, as well as perhaps a laboratory Albuquerque Weapons Center event on the nuclear warhead part of our deterrent. So I want to thank our friends from BASIC for putting this together, and want to welcome you here. I'm going to try to talk about 7 points. One, that we should remember that the United States and Great Britain, when they take actions with respect to nuclear weapons, are not the only nuclear powers. And no other nuclear powers, including officially the United States and Britain, accept the notion of zero nuclear weapons, though some do within our countries. And the question is, if other nuclear weapons are deployed, which they are, do nuclear weapons in Britain serve a useful deterrent role? Fourth, predicting threats is a tough job. I went back and looked at confirmation hearings since 1949. And the Secretary of Defense at the time, when you look at, were they asked about the wars that would come out in their term of office? And the point is, they never were. It's not that people were not smart, it is that predicting the future, as Yogi Berra once said, is very difficult. The other question, 5, is does the UK and the US deterrent affect proliferation? Next point, 6, is does a second center of deterrent decision making complicate the efforts of others to coerce the United States and its allies? And by making it that much more complicated to do so, lead to less likely miscalculations? And 7th, are rogue state nuclear programs really aimed at a response to US, UK, or other nuclear programs? Are they primarily dealing with the conventional capability the United States and its allies has to deter these countries from committing aggression? But before I address these points, let me also start with 3 things that I believe. I believe that the US and UK nuclear deterrent can and does do work in tandem, although they remain independent. They have to, given our constitutional processes. 2nd, extended deterrence has been critical since the beginning of the nuclear age and remains so, and as James Schlesinger has recently said, it is the single most important aspect of America's nuclear deterrent and those of our allies. And 3rd, I would remind people, this is especially true for our Central and Eastern European allies and our Pacific friends. Now, we cannot talk about these issues without some reference to the threat perception and security calculation in Europe. I could also take a look at Asia, but let me just do Europe and let's look at Russia. The CEE, which is the Central European folks, how do they perceive the threat calculation or the security calculation in that part of the world? They're greatly affected by the Russian invasion of Georgia in June 2008. And if you remember, Russia then followed that up with amphibious exercises in 2009, in which they landed in Kaliningrad. Their landing faltered due to NATO conventional intervention, and then the Russians decided to use nuclear weapons against Poland. The Allies have seen tangible Russian nuclear threats, especially given the great disparity between Russian and Allied tactical nuclear weapons. Fear is that this may result in very large political or diplomatic advantages for Russia. Fourth, especially worrisome, are the limited military attacks that have the potential for escalation. And in the Russians' view, escalation with nuclear weapons is a de-escalation. Let me repeat that. Mark Schneider pointed that out at the conference at King's Bay. Russian nuclear military doctrine believes that the use of nuclear weapons is a de-escalatory effort or activity. And fifth, it's very clear that the Russians say they reserve the right to use nuclear weapons not only in conventional conflicts, but in a way that incomparably lowers the threshold to the use of such weapons. And if you add to that the Russian use of cyber attacks, airspace incursions, the blockage of oil shipments, and the threatened use of nuclear-armed, for example, Iskander missiles, a pattern of bullying and intimidation is obvious. The Russians also recently, as you know, have taken their nuclear-armed bombers and decided to visit Venezuela and Nicaragua, no doubt for the Gulf. Now, how has NATO perceived these threats from Russia? Here, let me give you some views of alliance members as a whole and also officials in the various countries. The NATO Secretary General has said that the alliance needs to renew its commitment to collective defense. The Hungarian Defense Ministry said the following, quote, "The preservation of NATO's credible nuclear capabilities remain a pillar, key pillar of collective defense and solidarity. We see no need for significant changes in these current arrangements in light of the uncertainties we face." A joint statement in 2011 by NATO. Collective participation in a nuclear effort can aid in deterrence by showing a united front. General Clapper, in testimony in March 2013, noted that nuclear weapons can deter external attack, can deter intimidation and blackmail. Kurt Guthy, writing in the recently released National Institute of Public Policy paper in October 2013, quote, "Given greater role that nuclear weapons play in the doctrine and plans of the Russian armed forces, it is imperative for NATO to have a like capability to deter." And finally, Mr. Dirkolek, in a paper called NATO Defense and Deterrence Posture, published in Warsaw in 2012, said, "Nuclear and conventional capabilities are totally different kinds of armaments for very different kinds of contingencies." In light of that, then we ask this question, why do we need then an independent British nuclear deterrent, and what is its value to the United States? And to answer these questions, I think we need to keep some key issues in mind. A, first, our nation's adopting zero nuclear weapon postures so Britain can safely do likewise. Let's review the bidding. Nuclear weapons, by all accounts, are going to be a factor in global affairs for a considerable period of time. All, and I emphasize all, nuclear-armed governments do not embrace the idea of global zero now or in the immediate future or even in the midterm, except for some elements within each country. For those of you who want to know what countries with nuclear weapons think, I would suggest Jed Babin's book called In the Words of Our Enemies. Nuclear weapons, as I pointed out, are at the heart of Russian security doctrine and increasing in importance. Mark Schneider has testified before the House Armed Services Committee that 16 times in the last 5 years, Russia has explicitly threatened the use of nuclear weapons against American, European allies, and the United States. Russia doctrine explicitly says that NATO is the enemy. Russian exercises repeatedly feature limited nuclear strikes. Russian nuclear bombers routinely violate the airspace of Japan, the United States, Norway, and even the United Kingdom, and recently were deployed, as you know, in Venezuela and Nicaragua. Russia is working on a new SLBM, a new ICBM, a new bomber, as well as a new submarine. China is deploying two new kinds of ICBMs, a new SLBM, a new SSBN, and of course they have said they are not going to tell us how many nuclear weapons they have. They're not interested in nuclear weapons arms control, And as you know, their nuclear weapons budget is totally off budget. It is not something we know how much it is or how much they're planning to spend. And if we look at Pakistan and India, they are also improving and modernizing their nuclear deterrent. And North Korea now has estimates are between 10 and 12 nuclear weapons. And they certainly, as the late Kim Jong-il was asked, what about going to zero nuclear weapons as proposed by Global Zero, said, sure, you first. Now, we've also heard that nuclear weapons do not deter cyber attacks or terrorism or stop organized crime. Especially did not stop 9/11. It's not what they were built for. No one ever claimed that nuclear weapons are designed to stop all conflicts. They do, however, deter nuclear conflict between the great powers. They have done so for 68 years, and as Larry Welch points out, they have done so perfectly, despite the fact that if you go online and look under, just call Google conflicts in the world, you'll get over 400 of one kind or another, terror groups, militias, guerrilla groups, in 62 countries. And yet in that entire period of nearly three quarters of a century, the great powers have not reached for the nuclear holster. That is a record I think we need to contemplate when we think about, let's change how we're going to do this. And third, we have to deter states when they are contemplating the use of military force, whether or not that includes nuclear weapons or not, because as we know, conventional crises can lead to escalation and can lead to conflict at a higher level. By definition, of course, the attacks of 9/11 or other acts of terrorism were not only not stopped by nuclear weapons, they weren't stopped by law enforcement, the police, our conventional capabilities, the Coast Guard, NSA. In fact, by definition, of course, since they occurred, they weren't stopped by anything. But I don't see these same people who say that nuclear weapons should be abolished because they didn't stop 9/11 and say, should we abolish the Coast Guard and the FBI and the police departments or immigration? The thing is that deterrence is a spectrum across which we hope what we have capable does the job of stopping the next attack, which we, as you all know, are very difficult to predict. Next, in any case, given the presence of nuclear weapons, Britain, as well as its allies, needs to be protected from nuclear coercion, blackmail, even attack. How should we do that? There are those who say that Britain should eschew its nuclear deterrent and rely on the United States, for example, for its protection or rely solely on its conventional capability. Frank Miller recently spoke in Europe on this subject, in fact, in England, in Parliament. Let me say, quote you what he said. Quote, while Britain could rely upon somebody else for such protection, history suggests a more prudent model. During the Cold War, the British and American governments believed that two centers of nuclear decision-making enhanced deterrence because the Kremlin could never be absolutely certain that both countries would not retaliate to a nuclear attack. Faced with a credible independent British deterrent, we can be confident that a Russian government would understand that an attack on the United Kingdom would draw a retaliatory strike from the United States. In short, two centers of decision of deterrence decision raise deterrence itself as well as the barriers to the use of force. So if you decide to have a nuclear deterrent in Britain, we know that the current British Vanguard subs have to be retired at a date certain. The power plant simply will not work. And therefore, if you decide not to replace them, you're basically disarming unilaterally. I just returned from Kings Bay, as I've told you, in our Trident Atlantic base, and I talked to the head of the USS Alaska about the role that the British deterrent plays, and he says, we work in tandem and we work independent, and it makes any adversary of the United States much more or less certain that they can get away with aggression. Now, I won't do it here, but I think Frank Miller and Lytton Brooks have both laid out the alternative costs of a cruise missile, which takes a lot of time to build. You do need to build a new warhead. And then when you think of how many cruise missiles you need on station and where to deploy them given their lack of range, you're talking about a cost that exceeds the cost of replacing the Vanguard. Now the other question is, should we keep the deterrent in port? One of the things I find fascinating is that if you keep the subs in port and near Russia. We have professors at Notre Dame and Georgetown who have written that this is dangerous because the United States has a first strike capability against such weapons. You don't need a nuclear weapon to take out submarines in port. But on the other hand, if Britain keeps its ports, all its subs in port, that's somehow stabilizing. The question is, the essence of deterrence is to convince the other guy not to take the first move, not to go first. So that no matter what that person does, a crisis is not going to come out beneficial to them if they use force. Putting all your subs in port invites that first move. And that first move does not have to involve nuclear weapons. It can involve cruise missiles from submarines at sea. In short, there's no use having an insurance policy, which is secure retaliatory capability, but have it apply only some of the time. It's like having fire insurance on odd days of the week or every other month. Concluding, some notes, some cautionary notes, of which I have four. We know historically that small conflicts can escalate into bigger wars. I'm interested that very few people mention that in Syria, every single major nuclear power is involved. Russia, China has warships in the Mediterranean, Russia is the largest arms supplier, North Korea has pilots flying helicopters. The United States, France, and England are all interested in a settlement and an end of the civil war and seeing Assad go away. And there are not only chemical weapons, but less talked about are the biological weapons that Syria has. And then, of course, you have Hezbollah, and you have Al-Qaeda, and any number of terrorist groups, names I can't remember, and none of us know because they're made, I think they make them up about every other day. But when you look at the low-level terrorism all the way up to superpower, you have that all involved in one country, Syria, and ask yourself, can you predict credibly that this will not escalate to a conflict between the great powers? As I've noted and as Larry Welch has noted, nuclear deterrence has prevented war between the great powers for 68 years. There are numerous conflicts in the world, numbering in the hundreds, in 62 countries involving drug cartels, conventional militaries, guerrilla groups, terror groups, militias, and other armed groups, and yet the nuclear armed powers remain at peace. My second point is emphasized by two studies, one by Clark Murdoch of the Center for Strategic International Studies, and Georgetown professor Matthew Kronig, who spoke at my event in Kings Bay. They examined whether proliferation is diminished relative to the level of Russian and U.S. nuclear arsenals. And they came to the conclusion that as the U.S. and Russia have reduced their nuclear weapons, this has not had any effect that they can see on whether or not other states build up their nuclear weapons, including China, North Korea, India, or Pakistan. Third, there may well be a world in the future where conventional deterrence is our sole defense. The world prior to 1945 averaged 5 to 7 wars per century between the great powers between 1648 and 1945. As President Truman once said, you can look it up. The chief of naval operations noted that during the 20th century up to 1945, every year 1% of the world's population was killed in war. Every year since 1945, that number is 0.02%, or a 20-fold decrease. And fourth, to quote Lady Thatcher, when asked about all the monuments in France to their fallen French as well as other soldiers, including American and British, she said, "There is a monument to the failure of conventional deterrence in every French village." Thank you very much.